This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of November 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Now, it is no secret that the president-elect and I have some pretty significant differences. But remember, 8 years ago, President Bush and I had some pretty significant differences.
The fly on the wall is now the world's most wanted interview. President Barack Obama welcomes President-elect Donald Trump to the White House. My guests Michael Binion and Jacob Parakilis will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
He is from the private sector, not a politician. Can I get a hallelujah?
Whether top jobs await Trump's most fervid cheerleaders, Sarah Palin being just one. And what a Trump presidency might mean for the eternally vexed question of gun laws. And are we witnessing a new world record in overpromotion? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist at The Times, and Jacob Parakilis, Assistant Head of the US and Americas Program at Chatham House. Welcome both. And tempting though it is to look away, we must again turn to Washington, where the current tenant of the White House has been showing his successor around. President-elect Donald Trump... Nope, still sounds weird. Flew to Washington earlier in his private jet for a meeting with President Barack Obama, who yesterday made a punctiliously generous speech promising to work to ensure a smooth transition and going so far as to say that he was rooting for the success of a man he had previously described as uniquely unqualified. Michael, first of all, the two men have now met. The 15-minute meeting apparently went on for an hour and a half. There's been a slightly awkward photo call in which both of them tried to be nice about each other, didn't quite get the sense that either's heart was really in it. How do we imagine it went?
With some frostiness, I would imagine, but I think that Barack Obama would have been particularly courteous and generous and open-minded and trying to work out how his own legacy can best be ensured. In other words, not to really anger Trump to such an extent that all his own programs are in jeopardy. He is now thinking about his own legacy. Trump will be also quite restrained. He's, I think, really just wondering what on earth has now hit him. It's rather like anyone who suddenly wins an election they didn't think they would win, like the British Brexit vote. When it happens, when you do win, you suddenly think, oh my God, now what?
What I'm wondering, Jacob, and this is just a thought that occurred to me out loud, because Barack Obama is still the president until he ceases to be the president. Would it be legitimate of him, or indeed any president, to not necessarily, well, not even to go out of their way to help the successor, but actually try to sod things up as much as they possibly can? I mean, there is that popular rumour, I don't know how true it ever was, that Bill Clinton's team, as they were leaving, prized all the W's off the keyboards in the West Wing.
My understanding is that was not entirely untrue, but wildly exaggerated. It may have been done to one or two keyboards, but not all of them. No, I mean, I think that my guess is that Obama took the opportunity not to try to defend his policies, because he knows Trump is going to do everything he can to repeal them, and he knows he has a Republican Congress to work with. And there's no point in Obama actually trying to say, no, Donald, you don't understand Obamacare works and 22 million people. I think what he probably tried to do is impinge, sort of to give Trump the idea that the presidency is a really, really vast responsibility, and to try to get him to take it seriously. I don't know how successful that would have been. And I mean, I think, you know, yes, it is within the bounds of possibility that a president could direct their staff to make things intentionally difficult for the incoming administration. But first of all, that then distracts you from, you know, addressing any issues that crop up or need to be tied off before the end of the administration. And second of all, you just know that that's going to leak to the press, because the next administration will say, we were not given full cooperation, and they'll use that to blame. It doesn't actually slow them down. It just makes you look bad.
Michael, to what extent do you think Obama is being mindful of the passions that are now at large. There are, of course, a lot of people exceptionally angry about this result. I mean, there are always people disappointed in elections, but this is one of the ones where the people who've lost are angry. There have been fairly large-scale demonstrations against Trump already. And, of course, what is fueling the anger of a lot of people is what now seems the certainty that Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote by quite a decent margin. Is Obama mindful of that, do you think, and realizing that he has to try and keep people calm?
He certainly must be mindful, and the anger is certainly real. And indeed, the fact that Hillary Clinton may have won the popular vote is quite significant, because the last time that happened, which was when George W. Bush and Al Gore faced off and Gore won the popular vote, the row over that went on for quite some time, and it didn't go away quickly. And people were talking about whether that was a fair system or not. There is going to be the feeling we were cheated, the whole thing was fixed, and particularly...
Somewhat ironically, given the rhetoric that was at large beforehand.
Exactly. But I think the one thing that Hillary's supporters will certainly point to is the extraordinary role played by the head of the FBI, which does now look as though that decisively turned off a great many people when he said that her emails, a whole new cache of emails needed looking at.
And possibly also the head of the FSB, if you're reading.
Reading what
we're learning in the last few days.
Yeah.
I mean, Jacob, what's your view on that? I mean, because what's clear from the analysis that has been done is that, I mean, Donald Trump's vote is far from the most exorbitant mandate any candidate has ever had. I think I'm right in saying that more people voted, obviously, for Barack Obama, but for John Kerry, George W. Bush, John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Hillary Clinton. Why did so many Democrats stay home?
There are a lot of possible explanations. One that has to be mentioned is, I shouldn't say possible explanations, because I don't think this is a monocausal thing. I think there are a few different things that contributed. One is vote suppression, and it has to be mentioned. You know, the Republicans, following a Supreme Court decision, put in new restrictions about voter ID, about registration. They made it more difficult, predominantly in African American communities, for people to vote, and that's made it much more difficult for Clinton to win in places like North Carolina and Wisconsin that were determinative. That's not the only thing. I mean, Clinton's campaign... Look, every losing campaign is seen as incompetent and every winning campaign is seen as brilliant. I don't think that's really the case. I think Clinton's campaign was generally pretty competent, but they were running against a lot of headwinds. I think that the trends in Clinton's polling that were sort of diminishing were evident before Comey made his extremely... aggressive intervention. I think that probably exacerbated them. I don't think it created the closeness of the race. There's that. I mean, Clinton has been the subject of relentless and generally negative media attention for 30 years. And I think that also drove perceptions in a way that she wasn't really, and her campaign weren't able to overcome.
Michael, final thought on this before we look at some more specifics. As a foreign affairs specialist yourself, what have you made of the response of world leaders? Obviously, they're generally pro forma, more or less, at a time like this, but a couple of them have been quite interesting, I thought, especially Angela Merkel's.
Yes, a number of them have sent congratulations through gritted teeth, and a number of them have been conspicuously slow in sending their congratulations. Those that are not going to have to meet him don't really mind what they say. And so, you know, people like various officials in the European Union can sort of shrug their shoulders and make rather derogatory comments because they're not going to have to deal with him in the same way. The obvious ones who are pleased, they're generally populist leaders in their own countries. So, of course, Putin is sending warm and, I think, genuine congratulations, and people who are leading parties that look as though they're going to really benefit from this, such as the head of the National Front in France, Marine Le Pen, ecstatic in her congratulations, as you would expect. And the rest, well, they've got to work with the guy, so they're going to be saying things, finding whatever they can to say that's polite without being completely insincere.
Well, let's move along now, because Donald Trump's presidency will not just mean that Donald Trump is president. Among his many powers will be the awarding of more than 4,000 federal government posts, including, obviously, his cabinet. Even uttering out loud the phrase President-elect Donald Trump acknowledges that the bar of possibility has been lowered several dozen notches, but what further fresh hells await? Secretary of State Sarah Palin, Attorney General Rush Limbaugh, Treasury Secretary Alex Jones, some sort of Homeland Security role for David Duke, perhaps. Jacob, how bad can it be?
I think the way to look at it is probably through the frame of who he picked for his VP candidate. He didn't pick Sarah Palin. He didn't pick Ann Coulter. He picked Mike Pence.
And I've forgotten about Ann Coulter. That was those were happy hours. Thank you for spoiling them.
Sorry about that. Pence is a conventional, very right-wing, but largely seen as a conventional Republican. He and Trump clearly, and you can see it in the way they talk to each other, you can see it in the interaction, you could see it in the first 60 Minutes interview they did, where Trump basically talked over Pence and barely even mentioned him. They clearly don't have a close relationship, but I think what Trump wants to do is offload as much of the policy and the sort of nuances and minutiae of governance onto Pence as possible. I suspect he'll probably pick people in a similar vein for his senior cabinet roles. Just one, obviously, foreign policy, something we think about a lot in my role, Secretary of State. They've mooted three names, which I think gives a general sort of...
Okay, we're all sitting down, so go ahead.
Starting with the most outlandish, they've talked about Newt Gingrich as a possibility. And Gingrich certainly has the seniority. He was Speaker of the House. But here's a guy who is notable for talking about building a base on the moon as one of his main policy objectives. I mean, he's not really seem to be.
Is he volunteering to go and live in it? Because if so, I see some merit.
I think he might be disqualified on the grounds of age, unfortunately. He's the sort of outlandish possibility. It's only slightly less outlandish would be John Bolton, who was Bush's ambassador to the UN. Famously hawkish.
He spent most of his time at the UN telling the UN how much he hated the UN.
Essentially, yes. I mean, he is somebody who his instincts are somewhat more neoconservative. He's more in the let's build democracy by force overseas camp than Trump. But
that went really well last time.
In terms of the sort of. In terms of his instincts, I think he could probably be brought into line, just general aggression and sort of aggressive unilateralism, I think. Then there's Bob Corker, and Corker is the chairman of Senate Foreign Relations. He's the most sort of mainstream choice of the possibilities that have mooted. He's pretty widely respected. He's a very smart guy. He's capable of sort of talking to allies. So, you know, there's your range of possibilities.
Michael, do you think this may be a stupid question. Is he likely to make any, I guess, conciliatory appointments? I mean, Barack Obama, for example, named a Republican as Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel.
He might, yes. I think essentially, when all is said and done, Trump is a pragmatist. He knows how to win. He's a populist, but also he knows what works. And since he comes into this job with absolutely zero experience of politics, he's got plenty of experience of, you know, working with difficult people and changing opinions and all that. He's, to some extent, going to have to rely on the traditional Republican establishment because they're the guys who've been around, who
but
know
he,
how to
but
fix
But he owes them nothing.
And he doesn't owe them
anything. And indeed, given his record of sort of for pettiness and vindictiveness, he would also see the Republican establishment as people who tried to stop him.
Well, yes, but actually he's already made a few conciliatory remarks about the Republican Party and about the chairman of the party. And he's made some remarks suggesting that, you know, we're all in this together again and that this were, you know, just some misunderstandings. He is vindictive, but at the same time, he needs these guys to make things work. What his overriding ambition is, I'm going to make it work. I'm going to be the greatest. And to do that, he's got to ensure that everybody thinks like him and does what he asks. And therefore, he's going to bring in as many people as he can. I doubt if he'll make many Democratic appointments. That's not. But he might make an appointment from somebody way out, you know, a business leader or something completely from a different field.
Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State, perhaps.
I think not.
Jacob, do we anticipate, I guess, either senior Republicans deciding to sit this administration out or resignations even among military intelligence diplomats who just decide that they cannot work for Donald Trump?
There's a really interesting dynamic here because the foreign policy part of the Republican Party was the most resistant to Trump. You had letters going around with hundreds of high-level signatures saying he's unfit to serve. We will not support him. We will not vote for him. And these were people who'd served in Republican State Departments, Defense Departments, CIA, the NSA, the National Security Council. But the problem is now, you know, he's president-elect and he needs people to fill the lower profile but critical spaces in the NSC and the State Department, the regional affairs offices and the operational offices. And so those people suddenly have a very different set of incentives. And there's a lot of pressure now coming very publicly from senior Republican foreign policy people to, you know, I know you're not comfortable with it, but you need to, you know, he needs good advice. So go and serve in the Trump administration. But I still think you're going to find a mixture of people serving reluctantly and people who are underqualified or, let's say, differently qualified for the jobs that they're in.
I mean, to what extent, Michael, will he, or I guess should he, acknowledge the fact that, as we were discussing earlier, he has far from an overwhelming mandate. He lost the popular vote, for example. We were talking about the possibility of making conciliatory appointments, but should he make, I guess, some fairly obvious conciliatory non-appointments by, for example, would it be an easy win for him to obviously and ostentatiously not give jobs to people like Sarah Palin or Ben Carson or Mike Huckabee?
I don't think he will be very conciliatory over jobs. I think, yes, I don't think he'll appoint people because they were other prominent sort of Republican flag winners and flag wavers and right wingers, because he doesn't really care for them. He's the only populist in the establishment. I mean, it's all centered on him. I don't think he'll make appointments on that basis. I don't think he'll make very many conciliatory appointments, but he will choose a few people he thinks could, you know, look good and work well for him. And they may not be the obvious runners. He may bring in people completely from outside. Now, the question, I think Jacob made a very interesting comment about what were the people who are being asked to serve, what will they think? Now, there's a real dilemma. If you absolutely loathe somebody's guts and you think he will be dangerous and harmful, but you are an assistant secretary or you are a deputy whatever in an embassy, what do you do? I have to say, I don't want to make the comparison because that would be libelous, but the same dilemma happened to German diplomats when Hitler was appointed. They all said, the guy's a clown, he's an idiot. They didn't know he was a monstrous, murderous maniac. We just thought, an idiot and a clown. Do we stay and try to make it better and help him, you know, moderate his policies? Do we go along with it? Or do we say, this man is beyond the pale, unacceptable, and I'm leaving? And quite a number stayed, and they failed because they could not actually moderate the behaviour they hoped to do.
That is the dilemma at a moment like this. I mean, final thought on this one, Jacob. Is there one, because when a new prime minister arrives in this country, there's the professional rune readers are always terrifically interested in what are called the great officers of state, you know, Chancellor of the Exchequer, Home Secretary, Foreign Secretary. Those are the appointments which really show you what the prime minister is going to be. Is there one or two posts in the United States cabinet that especially tell you what kind of president we should be expecting?
Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of the Treasury, Attorney General are the top four. I would also say keep an eye on who he puts in at CIA, at the Director of the National Security Council, the National Security Advisor. He won't be able to appoint a new Fed chairperson until February 2018, so he's stuck with Janet Yellen. And the other thing, and it's not quite the same, look to see if he pushes publicly or otherwise to get rid of Paul Ryan, because Ryan and Trump had a very, very awkward relationship during the primaries. And Ryan finally endorsed him and then thought about unendorsing him, but then didn't, and then campaigned with him and then didn't, and then campaigned with him again. And Ryan is now talking a good game about unified Republican governance because he thinks that he can get his agenda through under Trump. I don't get the sense that Trump particularly likes or cares for Ryan, and he may think that there are enough Liberty Caucus types in the House Republican group that he can defenestrate Ryan and replace him with somebody more malleable.
Would he appoint one of his rivals for the actual nomination? Would he appoint Ted Cruz, for example?
Well, he couldn't appoint Cruz because Cruz is in the Senate.
Oh, yeah.
So he could. I don't think he would reward Cruz with anything. I think he probably wants Cruz to go away. But none of his really important rivals were in the House. And in the Senate, Mitch McConnell runs a very, very tight ship. And he managed not to clash with Trump. I think he and Trump will probably get along fine. I doubt the two of them have much affection for each other, but I think they'll have a perfectly workable relationship.
Okay, well, let's take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Michael Binion and Jacob Parakelis. Coming up next, we have checked again, and no, this is all definitely happening.
Ever since Justin Trudeau became Prime Minister, Canada has been in the spotlight. And that's just one of the reasons why we dispatched our team north for the November issue to look at everything from diplomacy to architecture, power players to good food. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the affairs section, we look at Canada's place in the world. There's an interview with Harjit Sajjan, the new defence minister, plus an on-the-ground report from Ukraine, where Canadian troops are training their Ukrainian counterparts.
In the business section, we touch down in Montreal to discover the city's aerospace expertise, whizzing round Bombardier's production facility and checking up on the company's all-new C-Series aircraft.
In culture, we inspect the state of Canada's outpost media, high up, far out, and proudly independent.
The November issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to join the team.
You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Binion and Jacob Parakilis. And while it is difficult to contemplate many legislative consequences of a Trump presidency without lapsing into hysterical cackling, there is possibly one counterintuitive consolation: that America's gun laws can hardly get more dysfunctional. Following Trump's election, the National Rifle Association crowed, "Trump's victory repudiates the assertion by gun control advocates that the political calculus regarding the Second Amendment has changed," which translates broadly as near. Jacob, does it actually matter that the NRA are so happy about Trump winning? Because obviously it's unlikely, or it seems to me unlikely, that Trump will attempt to make any difference to America's gun laws. But even when presidents do attempt to make a difference, it doesn't make any difference.
Gun laws are one of those things, and there are many of them, where Trump has reversed himself over time. He was at one point in favor of an assault weapons ban. He was in favor of mandatory waiting periods. He's now gone as far out as it's possible to go within sort of polite society in the U.S. In terms of gun laws. He doesn't believe in any kind of restrictions that are not currently on the books. He thinks that we need to proliferate more armed people out into society to stop.
It's going well so far, in fairness.
Yeah, there's very little evidence to suggest that that's an effective strategy, to put it mildly. For Trump, the guns issue is not about a deep cultural affinity for hunting. It's not about affinity for guns. It's about the fact that being sort of loyal to the gun industry's single issue gets him lots and lots of single issue voters. And a lot of those people are concentrated in places like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin. And guess what? He won Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin by small but real margins.
Michael, you were talking earlier about Trump as the businessman and Trump as the deal maker. Is there anything to the idea? And we hear this sometimes, that, you know, hardliners are better equipped to make peace because at least their opponents respect them, etc., etc., etc. Is there an argument that, should he be so minded, a maverick Republican conservative might be the kind of person who could get gun reform passed?
Possibly, yes, because he's got complete control. He's got Congress in his hand, both houses, and he will soon appoint a Supreme Court judge, so he will more or less have the Supreme Court swaying the way he wants. He's got all the levers of power. Now, if he wants to do it, he might be able to. I think it's much easier for Republican presidents to make deals overseas rather than at home. So on gun law, I'm not particularly hopeful he'll do anything, unless you have another or several other horrific massacres. But I do think he can sit down with Putin and say, look, let's just stop all this stuff. Let's fix Syria. Let's do this. Let's do this. You keep your area, I'll keep mine, and we'll get along fine. Now, that is a thing where I think he has interest and incentive, and it's a quick win. But I don't think gun law is so easy.
Jacob, Michael has raised what is going to be an inevitable feature of Trump's first term. There will be mass shootings on his watch. How do we imagine him responding to the first one, the first one of such scale and such horror that a presidential response is required?
I think, unfortunately, it's going to depend very much on the identity of the shooter. I think if the shooter is a white male, he will do what Republican politicians have done and write the individual off as an angry, disturbed loner and say he's sending his thoughts and prayers to the affected, and, you know, perhaps talk a little bit about improving mental health services. If the individual in question is African-American or Arab, I think he will have a much more aggressive response, which will not be be about improving gun laws. It will be about making an assumption on the group based on the ethnicity of the shooter.
Well, finally tonight, much has been made of the unlikeliness of the path that Donald Trump has negotiated to the White House. But he is not the first person whose first job in U.S. politics was president, although Dwight Eisenhower, for one, had amassed arguably more pertinent experience than building tacky hotels and hosting a game show. Michael, is this the most spectacular overpromotion in human history?
Well, you could say, based on his record and whether his businesses have been a success or they have bankrupted people or whatever, he is pretty much in areas where we don't have much of a positive background to say he's going to do it well. But on the other hand, the fact that he's been assaulted so many times by confrontations with unreality, I mean, where he's been told, look, you're on the verge of bankruptcy, you're going wrong, and he's recovered, and he's bounced back every time, makes you think he is pretty resilient. So I don't think he's over-promoted. I mean, he's a self-promoter, and he's promoted himself right to the top, and we'll now see whether his unbounded self-confidence can keep him going there.
He has made a virtue, of course, Jacob, of his outsider status. I mean, everybody running for office in America does that, apart from Hillary Clinton, who obviously couldn't. Why is it, do we think, and it's not unique to America, though it seems more of a thing in America, more of a tradition in America, why is it that held to be a virtue? Because in no other field that I can think of is one's lack of experience, lack of expertise trumpeted as an advantage. I mean, there's all sorts of things I cannot do that I am completely incapable of, unschooled in. I would not sort of seek to offer myself up as the person to do those things because the results would be terrible.
A lot of it has to do with the extent to which politicians themselves have been held to be responsible for the failings of the United States and the flaws of the United States, that it's all inside the Beltway thinking and the chumminess of the Washington cocktail set. And, you know, there are legitimate criticisms about the insularity of Washington and the disconnectedness of Washington and some other major urban financial centers with the country as a whole. But the idea that the problem is that there are people who are professional politicians who dedicate themselves to making policy to address the challenges faced by the problem is just, it's, you know, Trump's election is the culmination of this trend, as you rightly pointed out, where you know, people who are not politicians run on their outsider status and say, we're going to clean up Washington. We're going to drain the swamp, is the phrase that Trump has come to use. And it just it deprioritizes the fact that actually policy is really complicated and governance is really complicated. And running the most powerful country in the world is that, you know, squared. It's a vastly complicated system, and I think Trump is probably going to figure that out very, very quickly.
Do either of you know the feeling? Have you ever been promoted a mile out of your depth, Michael?
Like standing up and thinking, I'm making a speech now, what on earth am I going to talk about? usually something comes to mind at the last minute, and I manage to stagger through. Or going somewhere where you think, I actually don't know what I'm doing and where I'm going. Yeah, I haven't actually taken a job where I think I just can't do this job. I mean, luckily, I haven't put myself in that position. But I can imagine it's like those dreams where you suddenly think, I'm on stage and, and I can't remember any of the words.
Jacob, has this ever befallen you? Have you ever found yourself in a professional capacity thinking, I literally have not got any idea what I'm doing?
When I was 18 years old and I just graduated from high school, I spent a summer learning to be an emergency medical technician, which is sort of a, for non-American listeners, a sort of a junior paramedic. And the first day the only day that we did training driving the ambulance, most of the people there were volunteer firefighters and had been since they were 14 and had driven ladder trucks and rescue trucks and all sorts of things. And so they took us to the parking lot of a shopping mall and they put me behind the wheel of a 9,000-pound ambulance built on the frame of a Ford heavy-duty pickup. And the biggest thing I'd driven up to that point was my dad's minivan. And so the driver said, okay, so it's fine. It's just like every other, you know, truck you've driven. I said, I've never driven an ambulance before. And her eyes went wide and she said out loud, oh God, one of those.
and how did it go? I'm hoping this story doesn't end in some irresistible metaphor for a future Trump presidency.
I did. No. I never hurt anyone. I did once back into a road sign and completely level it, I'm afraid. But no. My driving was actually, that aside, my driving was fine.
Well, on that somewhat hopeful note, Michael Binion and Jacob Barrichellis, thank you very much both for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Judith Serra. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Music next, 1900 Hours. It's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.